demonology and the triphasic model of trauma, an integrative approach. A Good Omens fanfic written by NNM and performed by Starcatcher Betty. Chapter 6, Attachment Styles. Those who work in helping professions, like therapists, understand the risks. They are subject to burnout. They are subject to compassion fatigue, to vicarious trauma, to finding themselves falling apart at the seams as a result of the constant inundation of other people's needs. It's a risk, a constant risk, that the helper is trained to keep eternally in the back of her mind. How far can I go before I hurt myself? Therapists earn their bread and butter by convincing the broken and disheartened to engage in self-care. Many of them recognize the irony of it. Psychotherapists who specialize in trauma are at special risk. They earn their bread and butter by helping those who have undergone inexpressible horrors to try to express them. They smile. They breathe in deeply. They tear up. They encourage patience and resilience and self-compassion. And they do this all while confronting unimaginable stories of cruelty and abuse, the worst that humans can do to one another, the worst that can be done at all. Their job is to look head on at evil, to acknowledge it, and to find a way to work with it. Aubrey Time always had a knack for that. She was a professional, and she had over 10 years of experience working with cases of severe trauma. 10 years, she knew, was a long tenure for specializing in trauma. She had watched over those years as peers dropped away, dropped out, burnt out, and shriveled up. She would run into them at conferences, and she would see how they laughed softly, without the smile reaching their eyes, and mumble about how they had moved on. She would nod and soothe. She would say she understood, but she did not actually understand. Not really. Aubrey Time had always known she was good at her job. There are tricks and skills that trauma specialists can use to help them avoid, or at least stave off, vicarious trauma for as long as possible. It is a matter of simple compartmentalization. The trauma specialist trains her mind to separate itself into multiple compartments, to keep them apart, to access particularly challenging compartments only when it was professionally or personally appropriate. Keep them hidden, keep them secure, keep all the pain and horror and bile under lock and key until it was safe and appropriate to release it. It was an act of imagination. Aubrey Time had trained herself to compartmentalize by imagining a library cards catalog storage box. She would close her eyes between sessions and visualize it. It had 26 cabinets, each corresponding to a different letter of the alphabet. She kept its contents alphabetized. She would imagine running her fingers over the cold metal pull tabs which opened the drawers. Unlike a regular card catalog, this one had a lock on each drawer. She would imagine the sound the keys would make, turning in the lock. She would imagine the hook on the wall, where she visualized keeping a ring with 26 distinct keys, one for each of the catalog's cabinets. It worked for her. When she felt the need to, she would close her eyes and imagine an empty piece of card paper. She would pick up an imagined pencil, and then she would write whatever she needed to compartmentalize away on that imagined card. She would take the imagined ring of keys off the hook, moving to the appropriate drawer, unlocking it, and filing the card away. She would feel the dusty coolness of all the collected cards stacked in such pleasing order. And then she would close the drawer back up, lock it back up, put the keys back where they belonged. And then she would move on. She kept all the vile horrors she had heard locked up tight, accessible only when she needed them. She could access them when she needed them, and she could ignore them when she needed to. She could keep them cut off, stifled, unobtrusive. Aubrey Time could control them. Her card catalog system had grown more sophisticated and imaginatively solid over time, although it had undergone no major revisions for at least 5 years. Now, however, it did. She put in a new drawer, a 27th one. The new drawer squeezed itself in between C and D. It was the only drawer that had more than a letter on its front. What it said was, Crowley. That's where she would keep it all of it. Everything she knew, everything she felt, all her memories of the deep blue eyes that had felt like burning and drowning, all the shaking and confusion that came from what she could not find within herself to doubt, all the questions that ached viscerally. She stored it all away. She locked it up. She kept it there, locked up, hidden and safe, and thus out of the way. Aubrey Time was a professional, after all, and it was her duty to ensure she could perform her job for her clients without the uncomfortable intrusion of her own personal problems. So she locked them up, and she hid them, and she did her job. She would let them out when it was safe for her to do so, at night after she had finished her work for the day, on the weekends. During her personal time, she would let that drawer open, and she would let herself feel any number of things, and think any number of things, and respond in any number of ways. She would cope with it all, or at least try to cope with it, or use all the coping techniques she had at her disposal to find a way to live with it. Some of her coping techniques, she knew, were less adaptive than others. She understood this. She accepted this. She was satisfied with this. So long as the results were what she wanted, Aubrey Time could do whatever was necessary, personally, to ensure that she could be who she needed to be professionally. Aubrey Time was a survivor. She was a survivor, and she would do what she had to do in order to survive. She was a professional, and she liked being a professional. And that was why she had always survived. It was 25 minutes before her next session with Crowley was scheduled to start. She decided to leave her office. Her plan was to go outside, go stand in the sun, close her eyes, and visualize the locks and keys on her card catalog. Her plan had been to let the fresh air soothe the headache she hadn't been able to shake all day. That was her plan, 25 minutes before her session with Crowley was scheduled to start, and that was why she had opened the door to her waiting area. She opened the door to her waiting area 25 minutes beforehand, and she saw that he was already there. "You're early," she said, standing in her doorway, feeling at sea. "No," he said, cool and collected, not shifting one bit in response to her presence. "I'm just not late." He had never been early before. Not that she knew, at least. She saw him. She saw that he was sitting. He was not sprawling, not slouching, not reclining, but sitting, like any normal human would. He was holding in his lap a copy of Better Homes and Gardens that had occupied her waiting area's coffee table for at least 3 years. His head was angled down, as one would expect from someone reading a magazine. She couldn't find within herself the ability to believe he was actually reading it. Usually, when he wore his sunglasses, he used his brow and head angle to compensate, to let her know where he was looking. He did that, at least, when he wanted her to know. Apparently, right now, he didn't. It was possible that he had shifted his eyes to watch her, but he gave no indication that he had done so. He looked like a human reading a magazine. "Well," she said, because she could think of nothing else to say, "I'll see you in 25 minutes." He gave no reply. There was nothing else to do about it. She stepped back into her office, and she shut the door again. 25 minutes she had to spend waiting. She took several deep breaths. She dry swallowed 2 aspirin. She rubbed at her temples. She was not prepared, and she would not be prepared. And he was already there in her waiting area, conspicuously just not late. On her desk, she had a pad of sticky notes. She sat down and collected it. She also collected a pen, and then she sat for several long minutes, looking at the empty yellow note. She would write herself a reminder. Not the kind of reminder that was alphabetized away, hidden away, so it could do no harm. Instead, it would be the kind of reminder that she needed to keep real and tangible. She wrote, "He's a person." Afterwards, she adhered the sticky note to the inside wall of her desk drawer. She would keep it there, safe and secure. It would be accessible there whenever she found herself in need of it. When she sat in her chair during a session, she would be able to glance over to it to remind herself it was there. After 25 minutes had passed, she stood, opened the door, and invited him in. "Ground rules," she said, once he was seated. "For what?" he asked. He was, again, sitting, and it was unsettling. He looked uncomfortable. "For everything," she said, making a broad gesture of the room. "All of this." "Aha," he said, and he nodded. He understood. She thought she saw him start to lean back to get into his comfortable sprawl, but then he stopped himself. "What do you have in mind?" "Actually, let's start with you," she said, because she had anticipated that response. Beyond that, though, she was not sure. She was not sure what he would say, what ground rules he would need or find acceptable, how the dynamic between them would be different or the same. She felt unprepared, and she hated feeling unprepared, and she was working to keep it hidden. "Now that I know what I know," she faltered, lost her pace. She was annoyed at herself for falling into euphemisms, and she was annoyed, equally, that she couldn't quite bring herself to rephrase it. "Is there anything you think you need from me?" "Well," he said, too quickly for him to actually take in her question seriously, "exorcisms are right out." She put on a grim look. "They don't even work on this body, but they're really annoying." "You're making a joke of this," she said. "No, I'm not," he said in a side-out kind of way, in the kind of way that meant, "I was, but I'll stop now." Again, she saw him twitch a little, as if he wanted to sprawl out, but stopped himself from doing so. "No holy water. Don't bring any holy water in here." He wasn't joking anymore, but the words made her feel like laughing. Aubrey Time was not someone who had ever interacted, either professionally or personally, with holy water. "I think I can manage that." "I'm serious," he said, and he sounded like it. "Right. Okay." So that was another thing to file away. Holy water was real, and it was serious. "What else?" He tapped his fingers on the arm of his chair. He made a collection of "I'm thinking" faces. "Oh, don't use his name."
He has a name?"
"Huh?
I didn't know he even had a name."
"Of course he has a name. Who doesn't have a name?"
"I thought he didn't." She was confused. He looked annoyed. "So what should I call him?"
"It doesn't matter, so long as it's not his name. The evil one, Prince of Darkness, the massive prick, whatever."
"Wait."
"What?"
"You're talking about," she pointed downwards, "him?" Now he looked confused.
"Who did you?"
She pointed upwards. Crowley followed the line made by her finger, and then he hissed out, "Oh, for Earth's sake." He lifted his glasses enough to rub at his eyes, and he shook his head.
"No, Herb, no.
She has a name, too, but I don't think you know it.
She?
Mm-hmm.
Really? She?
Yep.
Huh.
Aubrey Time thought about that, but then she thought about it some more. She found she had a lot to think about that, especially within her professional capacities.
You really did work with Freud, didn't you?
Don't you dare, he warned, now scowling at her. But it was a friendly scowl. Ground rules.
Right.
She accepted that. She got it. She shouldn't have let that question out at all, she recognized. Okay, let's get back on track. Anything else? He shrugged. He looked off to the side, and then he turned back to look at her. He made it very clear that he was looking at her. You doing all right? He asked. He asked it like a concerned friend, but he was not her concerned friend. He was her client. He asked it like she might not be all right, like she would tell him if she wasn't. But she wouldn't.
Thank you for your concern,
she said, and she smiled. She said it like a professional, and she smiled like a professional, because that's what she was.
Any other ground rules you need?
He said, sounding thoughtful, sounding unsatisfied. He was still looking at her. He looked, not like he was judging her, but like he was making judgments about her. She didn't like that. How's the tree? Of course he would ask about the tree. Of course he would. The tree was a goddamned annoyance. Aubrey Time did not care about the tree. She did not care about plants, either professionally or personally, and she had no interest in trying to keep things like trees or flowers or vines alive. This tree in particular was both a professional and personal nuisance. It was, in her mind, Aziraphale's tree, not hers. If Crowley thought of it the same way, there'd be hell to pay when she inevitably killed it. And it would take hard work to make that into a therapeutically valuable experience for him. Looks like it's doing fine, she said simply. It would do better if you moved it over by the window, he said, and he even gestured towards the window, as if she needed a reminder about where it was located. Not enough sunlight where it is now. This reminded her that he was a gardener, that he liked plants. She knew he kept a garden, and she knew that he was deeply proud of it. She knew how proud of it was, because he never mentioned it without insulting it. I'll keep that in mind, she said, stifling her desire to chuck the damned tree out the window. Back to our ground rules. It's just, you know, I feel responsible for it, he said. She wanted him to shut up about the damned tree. She wanted him to move off the subject. She also wanted to get back to the ground rules because she had some very important points to raise. But even more, she wanted to understand why he had just cut her off to say this, of all things. Crowley, she well knew by this point, almost never accepted responsibility for anything. It's the way it is because of me, isn't it? He went on. He tilted his head to the side, and he was looking at her, and she was growing so annoyed with him because he was still sitting and not sprawling. I did that to it. My responsibility. I take responsibility for it. Aubrey Time knew her job. She knew exactly how she should respond to what he was saying. She knew the precise therapeutic move to make, given what he had just said, given the way he had emphasized the words my and take. She knew what she should say was, this isn't about the tree, Crowley, is it? She should put him on the spot. She should make him acknowledge that he was talking in code. But she wouldn't do it. She wouldn't ask that question. Because then she suspected he would put her on the spot. And she couldn't have that. My tree, she said. My responsibility. He didn't respond. beyond a clack noise he made with his tongue. At least, he finally scooted down a little in the seat, into a half-sprawl.
"Tell me your ground rules, Aubrey time."
She paused to take a deep breath. She closed her eyes just momentarily so she could take the card out, on which she had written, "The damn tree," down and put it back where it belonged, in her card catalog, and lock it up nice and tight, where it would be safely out of her attention until she had the time and energy to deal with it. After 10 years of experience, she was good at doing this. She could do it quickly, looking barely like she had done more than taken a long blink, and her client would not even know. Aubrey Time was a professional. "Okay, Crowley," she said, mostly to buy herself time. "Look, let's start with this." She was uncertain. This felt like dangerous ground. "What did you do to my other clients?" He raised an eyebrow. He opened his mouth to speak. She couldn't remember if his teeth had always looked that sharp.
"Nothing bad," he said.
"Crowley." Maybe she felt sick. She was a professional.
"Nothing bad," he repeated more emphatically. "Look, you were in no shape to see other clients last week. Would you have preferred they all just showed up? I took care of things."
"That was a violation of federal law," she said with significance, with feeling. She felt her nostrils flare. She felt her lips twitch.
"Is that what you care about?"
He sounded surprised, unimpressed.
"I also didn't drop by customs when I popped over here today. You worried about that, too?"
She wasn't gritting her teeth. They weren't clattering. She was a professional, and this mattered. "You leave my other clients alone." Something flicked across his face. A quick expression. Something that looked like rage. But then it was gone, and his face was still.
"I did not hurt them, Aubrey. I wouldn't do that."
There were a number of different potential responses available to her. None of them, however, would have been professional. None of them had therapeutic merit.
"Ground rules," she said. "Leave my other clients alone."
He looked like he, too, had a number of different responses available to him.
"Fine," he said. "Not a problem. Don't worry about it."
3 times, she noticed. He agreed to it 3 times.
"Thank you," she said.
She nodded at him. She felt too tired to smile. Her headache hadn't gone away. She watched as he bit at the side of his cheek, giving no response. She acknowledged to herself that she should check in with him, ask about how he was feeling. She should ask about that expression she had seen on his face. She should admit that she felt uncertain and even a little scared. She should be willing to say the word demon. Aubrey Time was very capable of recognizing the many things she should be doing.
"Okay," she said. "One more thing. You up for one more thing?"
"Fine," he said, although he didn't mean it.
3 sessions ago... she said to start. She wasn't comfortable. She felt her lip twitch again.
"You did something to my clock, didn't you?" Aubrey Time knew her client, Crowley, fairly well at this point. She knew how to observe him. She knew that he thought best when he could move, the physical activity freeing up his mind. She knew that their therapeutic alliance was the strongest when he was willing to throw petty insults at her. And she knew it was at its most frayed when he grew slow, when he stilled, when he sat silently tense.
Over the past week, Aubrey Time had found herself reading up on herpetology. She hadn't felt that any of it was useful at the time,
But now, as she watched her client, Crowley, she could not help but compare the intensity of his motionless posture to the images and videos she had seen.
"What if I had?" he said finally.
"That's unacceptable," she said.
"Unacceptable?"
he repeated, and there was an edge to it, an edge that felt dangerous. It was an edge she had heard in his voice before, and it was something she normally would have paid very close attention to. Normally, she would have done something about it, made sure he was aware of it, helped him through it. But not now, not about this.
"Unacceptable," she said, and it was like a foot coming down. "I didn't do anything to your clock," he said.
He was angry. She could see that he was angry. She had a headache, and she was tired, and she wanted to get home so she could cope, but she could see how angry she had made him, and she could also hear him, the way he sounded as he was angry, and the way he sounded out the words, "to your clock," and it made her remember that Crowley was a liar.
"Let me rephrase that," she said, squinting shut her eyes, letting herself think. "Did you do anything to me, or to this room, or to anything that led us spending less than a total of 50 minutes working together 3 sessions ago?"
"It doesn't matter," he said.
"It does," she said.
"It doesn't matter," he repeated, like saying it could make it true. It couldn't.
"You interfered with our work."
"No, I didn't."
He was a liar.
Aubrey Time was angry. She could acknowledge to herself that she was angry. She was angry in the middle of a session with a client who was also angry. She was viciously angry. She was spitting angry, biting angry, raging angry. She felt like kicking in his 2 sharp teeth.
"We work in 50-minute increments, Crowley," she said. "That's what we agreed to when you first came here, and you interfered with that."
She had a headache, and she was tired, and she needed a chance just to cope. But even a therapist who is tired and aching is able to understand anger. Aubrey Time had always understood anger. Anger was, after all, what so many trauma survivors thrive in and through. She understood that anger works as a mask for other emotions, deeper and more vital emotions. Anger masks shame. It masks fear. It masks sorrow. Aubrey Time may not have felt well, but she understood that she was angry, and she understood that anger functions as a mask for shame and fear and sorrow. She refused to interrogate which of those 3 options her current anger was masking.
"Fine," he said, or rather he spat. He sneered at her, and it wasn't a friendly sneer. It was an angry sneer, because he was just as angry as she was.
"No," she reconsidered. He was angrier than she was. He was angry because anger masks shame and fear and sorrow. He was angrier than she was because in this instant he had far more to lose than she did.
"I get it," he spat out again, and he pushed himself out of his seat, and he sneered again, and then he was off, stomping, and he was storming his way out of the door. He was gone. He had stormed out and he had left in the middle of their session and her office was empty.
1 second. She sat across from the empty seat, her whole body thrumming. 2 seconds. She breathed in. 3 seconds. She decided if he wasn't back in 15 minutes, she would call him. 4 seconds. And he was back. He stormed back into the room with the same amount of explosive energy as he had left with. He pushed himself back into his seat. He sat, hunched over, hands clutching each other between his knees. He didn't even look at her. He was looking instead at the floor between them. She estimated 4 seconds seemed like enough time for him to storm his way to the edge of her waiting area and then storm back. It did not, however, seem like enough time for him to storm out, pause to reconsider, and then storm back. He hadn't had to think about it. He had never planned on going farther than he needed to prove his point. It had simply been a test, a trial run. It wasn't a test of leaving. She was certain he needed no practice to do that. He had left, and then he had turned, and he had tested whether he could come back. He had been angry. She had been angry. She had called his behavior unacceptable, and still, he had been able to come back. By this point in the relationship, they were very good at sitting in silence with one another. It had lost its awkwardness long ago. They both had substantial experience sitting with each other's breaths. They could sit with one another in silence as they calmed. "I'm glad you came back," she said. She meant it. He didn't respond. He kept looking at the floor between them. He was still, but not like before. The taut anxiety was gone. There was a quietude to his stillness. He sucked on his teeth like he was thinking. "I probably wasn't ready for this yet," she said. She considered tacking on, "I'm sorry," but she decided against it. Now was not a time to push him. She already had, and she hadn't been very conscientious about it. It wasn't what either of them needed, not right now. What they both needed right now was to do something else entirely. "Have I ever told you," he asked, sounding cautious, "how Aziraphale and I met?" She smiled. She couldn't help it. His wording was charming. He had not said, "let me tell you." He had not said, "you really should know." He had not said, "I really want to say this." He had instead used such a casual wording, the sort of wording that works for an anecdote between friends, like a story told and retold 100 times at one's favorite bar. He chose his wording, even though there was absolutely no way either of them could think he ever had told her before about how he and Aziraphale had met. He chose this wording because he understood it was what both of them needed. "No," she said, still offering her smile. "I don't believe you have. I'd love to hear it." "Okay," he said. He looked up at her, and he smiled back. He leaned back for the first time that day, and she watched him sprawl out in his chair as if he had never learned what it was meant to sit. "This was right after the apple," he said as a start, and then he kept going. It was a good story, a sweet one, the way he told it, although it was not artfully told. Aubrey Time realized that this could quite possibly be the first time he had ever told it to anyone. She wondered about that, about what to make of it, about what 6,000 years of holding in all of one's stories could feel like. She wondered what Aziraphale's version of the story would be like. She wondered all of this, but she also listened. She gave him her attention. Her head hurt, and she was tired, and she desperately needed to cope. But she could give him her attention. This was a story that mattered to him, and it was something she could cherish, for his sake. He told stories for the rest of the session. They were true stories, stories about him, about Aziraphale. They were, all of them, easy stories. There was no pain. Or if there was, he skipped over it. There were hard stories he would have to tell in the future. There were stories he would have to tell filled with pain and cruelty, and there would be therapeutic work for them to do with those stories. But these stories were different. These were not stories for them to do therapeutic work with, but instead through. Crowley told her stories, and that was how they learned to inhabit their new normal.